From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Austin Sarrett says there's a kind of pattern to the technology we use in the death penalty. When a new invention comes along, a gas chamber, an electric chair, he says we proclaim the methods we were using, the beheadings or hangings, as barbaric and archaic. The public is looking for an execution that is clean and efficient and painless. But what if we set that pattern aside? In the wake of concerns over lethal injection, some lawmakers are suggesting we return to the tried and true method of a firing squad. Well, today in the program, we're talking about capital punishment, some of the ethical questions at stake, how we've evolved in our thinking about the issue, and what we go through when we decide to kill a person. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few days ago, Utah lawmaker attracted national attention for his suggestion that seemed outrageous to many, that Utah ought to reconsider the firing squad as an option for the death penalty. Well, it's important to say that it wasn't all that long ago that Utah actually used the firing squad. The last execution in this state in 2010 for condemned killer Ronnie Lee Gardner, that was a firing squad. But people are reacting to the news of a botched execution in Oklahoma, and it's raising questions, again, about the death penalty, the ethical ones, the technical ones. And that's what we're talking about today in the program. Robert Blecker is joining us first. He's a professor of law at New York Law School and author of the book, The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. He's joining us today from a studio at Carnegie Hall in New York City. And Professor Blecker, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with there's this kind of personal dimension that you give to this issue in your book. And you talk about the perspective of your parents. Your mother, for example, staunchly opposed, you say, to the death penalty, but you say she made an exception for Hitler. Explain that. Explain why she did and what – because you're making a bigger point here.
Yes, I am making a bigger point. I mean she did it probably because it was the post-World War II era. She had just lived through it. The revelations were now undeniable about the Holocaust. She identified with it, and she realized that there is an extremely small category of people who are just simply so bad that even against a general opposition to the death penalty, they deserve to die. The larger point, of course, connects to the public opinion polls, which tend to be structured in such a way as to indicate a lower support for the death penalty than in fact exists. Americans support the death penalty to a much greater degree. The standard question that's asked is, are you in favor of the death penalty for someone convicted of murder? And phrased that way, if you imagine the host of possible murders that can range from felony murder to the most gruesome torture killing and the rape and mutilation of a child, It's difficult to answer that. In 90% of the cases, I'm against the death penalty for someone convicted of murder. So I guess my answer would have to be no, even though I'm a death penalty supporter. So the point that's made at the beginning of the book, directly to answer your question, is that when you give people concrete examples of the worst of the worst of the worst, and you ask them, what is the appropriate response? The answer is, to a much greater degree than the public opinion polls reflect, support for the death penalty as the only legitimate and appropriate response to the worst of the worst of the worst.
In your book, you work through some philosophical perceptions of this question, and you quote Aristotle, for example, in his book Ethics. It is easy to get angry. Anyone can do that. But to feel or act towards the right person to the right extent, at the right time, for the right reason, in the right way, that is not easy. Does that express your sense of the sort of ethical issue here?
Very much so. And do note that it's based upon thousands of hours these past 25 years spent in maximum security prisons and on death rows in 7 states, interviewing convicted killers, some of whom have been condemned to die and some of whom have been condemned to live in prison for the rest of their lives, and the people that guard them. Yes, it's very easy to get indiscriminately angry, and it's much more challenging to get angry in the right measure, in the right way, at the right people. And so that's what the book tries to do. It offers a refined death penalty statute that reflects now, I think, a greater appreciation of who the worst of the worst of the worst really are. It offers a refined mission statement for the departments of corrections so that punishment appropriately becomes part of our response. Because, I mean, you asked the right question at the beginning of the hour in introducing the segment. Should it be punitive or should it be efficient? Not that they're necessarily contradictory, but it should be punitive. So, yes, to answer your question, yes, I think Aristotle, who is obviously extraordinarily wise, nailed it. The challenge is to get angry in the right way, at the right people, on the right occasions, and with the right response.
You point out that you have known early on that, as you put it, prejudice can stain the system, that trials do not guarantee justice. And it's interesting, your perspective is interesting because you became disillusioned, for example, by Abraham Lincoln, by the Bible, among other things that you encountered that revealed what? Hypocrisy and a sense of inconsistency for you?
Well, in the case of the Old Testament, remember, it calls for genocide at one point. The Hebrews are commanded by God to wipe out the Canaanites, every man, woman, and child, who had done nothing wrong except they were living in the wrong place. And in the case of Lincoln, whom I embraced as a child until my social studies teacher required me to actually read the Emancipation Proclamation and stand up before the class and tell them exactly which slaves Lincoln freed. Of course, it turns out that Lincoln freed all but only those slaves he couldn't free. Only the slaves in states that were in rebellion against the Union were freed. And in those states which, in fact, the Union Army controlled, such as Maryland, he freed none of them. So I came to be disillusioned with those authorities and searched for others.
Yeah. This idea that you came to, that certain people did in fact deserve to die, really put you at odds with some of your peers, especially in the anti-war movement, which you were very involved in. And people attacked you, you say, for what they called this absurd inconsistency. How can you be anti-war and for the death penalty?
Yes, I was. I was ostracized as an undergraduate in college. And one of the profound influences in the abolitionist movement, whom I know Austin Surratt respects enormously and after whom he won an award, Hugo Bideau was in fact the chairman of the philosophy department at Tufts where I was an undergraduate. So I had to flee that. And there was no room for me there. And again, I was attacked for being inconsistent there and in law school. How can you be anti-war, anti-Vietnam War, and pro-death penalty? And my answer was and remains, there's nothing inconsistent about those two positions. We were killing the wrong people. Here we were napalming whole villages of a country whose leader, Ho Chi Minh, had based his constitution on the United States Constitution, was an enormous admirer of America, not American business interests, but America and the political system for which it stood. And Dwight Eisenhower canceled the elections, the free elections of Vietnam, and explained why. He said because if free elections were held tomorrow, Ho Chi Minh would win 80% of the vote. Well, that's a good reason to cancel them. And at the same time, Richard Speck, who had murdered 8 student nurses, there was a 9th who was under the bed as he raped and brutally murdered the others, was being served breakfast in bed. So for me, there was nothing and remains. There's nothing inconsistent. We have an obligation to find out who the worst of the worst of the worst are, and to let the punishment fit the crime. So there's nothing inconsistent about being against an unjust war and in favor of just punishment.
As you explored, went deeper into the philosophy of this question, I wanted to get a sense of that because you write about this. The philosopher Jeremy Bentham had this kind of, as you describe it, this kind of utilitarian calculus in terms of punishment. And part of this appealed to you. The sense of order was appealing to you. But in the end, you were kind of disappointed by it. You thought it may have seemed rational, but it, as you say, it felt, your word, it felt wrong and it felt unreal. Explain that.
Yes, it was a crisp kind of rationality that people, this is the utilitarian perspective even today, which justifies punishment on the basis principally of deterrence. That is, that people are rational, calculating maximizers, that pleasure is good, pain is evil, and that people will calculate and discount future pain by its severity, its certainty, and its swiftness. And so the prospect of a crime offers immediate pleasure. The prospect of punishment offers remote and uncertain pain. And therefore, the state, in order to effectively keep citizenry law-abiding, would have to threaten greater pain, which once discounted would still, in a cost-benefit calculus, offset the immediate pleasure from crime. It was all future-oriented. It was all rational. It was very crisp. Also, by the way, and this hooks in very essentially to Austin Sarat's new book, which I know you're going to be discussing, Gruesome Spectacles, the utilitarians are about appearances. So that from a utilitarian perspective, punishment should appear as painful as possible and yet be experienced as painlessly as possible. But it's all rational, it's all calculating, and it's all future-oriented. It failed me intuitively because I felt certain, and that's a very consciously chosen phrase, feeling certain. It includes feeling and intuition. I felt certain that the past counts, that we make covenants with the dead, covenants that we're obliged to keep, covenants that we can't justify on the basis of future benefits and on the basis of cost-benefit calculations, but covenants that are real. Even if they are not strictly rational, they are real. And that's the retributive perspective on punishment, which the utilitarians such as Bentham do not embrace.
Yeah.
And that is, once again, that the past counts, that the essence of justice is making the punishment fit the crime, not necessarily because it's going to give us future benefit, but because we are committed to it, because the past has a call on us. So, yes, Bentham did fail me, at least my feelings, my intuitive feelings about justice and desert.
People should die for the sake of the past, is how you put it in the book.
Yes, people should die for the sake of who they are, what they did, and the attitude with which they did it. And principally, some people should die for the experience of their victims, the experience that they put their victims through, that we reconnect. We have an obligation to reconnect with their victims. And that's part of, in my view, what's so terribly wrong, not only with the death penalty system in America, but also with prison administration. And that is that we have done almost all that we can to sever the crime from the punishment, that we don't connect it to the past. We don't do it in the ritual of the execution, and we don't do it in the administration day to day of prison life.
So you stopped trying to find a kind of pragmatic justification for capital punishment. Bentham disappoints you. Plato really doesn't work. You did at least initially find what you were looking for in Immanuel Kant, who said that only the law of retribution can determine exactly the kind and degree of punishment. That connected with you, I guess, at least at first.
Yes, it did initially, and it still does. I mean, Immanuel Kant is the leading classical retributivist that we have. But for Kant, it's all and only about duty. That is, he says at one point, if a society were to dissolve itself, its last act before it dissolved would be to kill all its murderers. But they shouldn't be angry. It should just be duty and dutifully done with no anger, with no emotion. Mm. And that's what left me cold. Because I think it anger is appropriate. I mean, I look to Adam Smith and Fitzjames Stephen, who is a great English historian, 19th century judge, as sort of my guides. And there is an appropriate role for hatred. There is an appropriate role for anger in the criminal justice system. If a jury doesn't hate the person who is before them in their life-death decision, my view is the jury ought not to condemn that person to die. That emotion appropriately plays a crucial part. It's both a lens for knowing what's right, and it's also a source of intuition. Now, it's got to be restrained emotion. It's got to be informed emotion. Reason also plays an enormous role. But the problem with Immanuel Kant is that for Kant, reason plays all of it, and emotion plays none of it.
Mm. Kant also wrote this, that the death of the criminal must be kept entirely free of any maltreatment that would make an abomination of the humanity residing in the person suffering it. And I'm guessing this is the part of Kant that disappoints you a bit, because you say in the book that you want the criminals who are put to death to feel their victim's pain before they die. What do you mean? Should it hurt?
Not uniformly. And I mean, let's be clear. The execution of Lockett in Oklahoma, the so-called botched execution of Lockett in Oklahoma, may have resulted in 45 minutes of pain and suffering before he died in a heart attack. And I emphasize may, because we don't know that yet. It could well be that he appeared to be in pain where he actually was not, which of course would fulfill and should fulfill the utilitarian program in which appearances of punishment should be much more painful than the actual experience of it. The execution in Ohio of McGuire, which the press had a field day with, especially the abolitionist press, it turns out most probably did not involve any experiences of pain. But if we designed, to get to the point, if we designed the procedure to inflict 45 minutes of pain and suffering on Lockett, then in my view, we would have violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, and we would also violate human dignity. So it cannot be the program. That would be an illegal and unconstitutional execution if it were intentionally designed to do that. On the other hand, when you recall what Lockett did in terms of the shooting, the rape, and watching, making his victim watch as they dug her grave while she was bleeding and then buried her alive, if he did in fact experience 45 minutes of pain, not as designed but as so-called botched, if he did experience that, there would be in fact a poetic justice attaching to it, even though it would not be a legally just execution. I further distinguish between some people who deserve to die and clearly experience no pain because they made sure that their victims experienced no pain, and those who are torture killers. Now, if they die painfully, again, that's appropriate. Whether it's consistent with the Eighth Amendment as part of a consciously designed system of punishment is much more deeply problematic, but it does not disturb me greatly if some subset of those who deserve to die do in fact die a quick but painful death. Let me emphasize quick. Torture was unquestionably outlawed by the founding generation of this republic. We are deeply committed to outlawing torture, and the Eighth Amendment definitely prohibits it.
Should executions, I mean, there's this question of whether or not we've come to the point in terms of the technology that we use, that we've come to sanitize executions, sanitize the process of the death penalty. I'm wondering, what do you think in terms of methods used? Lethal injection is one that seems entirely clinical, entirely invisible is a term that has come up. So what kind of methods are you thinking about? And are you thinking about the question of whether these should be public affairs again, that the public should witness these things?
Yes, I am thinking about that. And you say sanitize, and you're right. And something very closely associated to that, of course, is that we've medicalized it. This is part of the deeper phenomenon of our shame at punishment. I'm against lethal injection and have long been against lethal injection as a method of punishment, not because it might cause pain, but because it certainly causes confusion. It merges medicine with punishment. How we punish those whom we rightfully detest should in no way resemble how we treat those whom we love. I witnessed an execution, and the final scene at the execution was so bizarrely and eerily similar to the last scene at a hospice with my father-in-law, who was dying from incurably painful cancer. Both of them were wrapped in a gurney and in white sheets with an IV coming out of their arms, surrounded by medical technicians and their loved ones, and it was bizarre. The two scenes shouldn't resemble each other. So the method is wrong. It conflates punishment with medicine. What I would prefer is, I guess, the firing squad, which is what you began the segment with. Mm-hmm. It acknowledges what it is. It is punishment. It is not medicine or medicalized. It's not sanitized. It is what it purports to be. It's punishment. I might also allow a member of the victim's family, if they chose, to take the first shot. And again, reconnect it. The last statement at the execution scene should not be the condemned's last statement, or if it is, then the next to last statement should be a videotape of the victim's last birthday party, so that we understand, we reconnect crime and punishment. We reconnect the brutality of the murder with our response. This is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it. So of all the traditional methods, the firing squad seems to be the most appropriate.
You mentioned the idea of refining the statute, refining the mission statement. What does that look like, this mission statement, for example?
I'm sorry. Well, presently, in terms of the corrections mission statement, if you spend time in prisons, you come across a deep and very disturbing paradox, which is that inside prison, it's nobody's job to punish. When you ask the corrections officers, what are you doing here? What's your mission? What's your goal? Their answer is, my goal is safety. I want to keep the people safe from these prisoners. I want to keep the prisoners safe from each other. And I want to keep the staff safe from the prisoners. And you ask them about the crimes that they committed, the prisoners committed. And they said, what a guy did out there is none of my business. My only concern is, how does he behave once he's inside? So once you've severed the crime from the punishment, what you discover is that the people who commit the most brutal crimes, those who prey on their helpless victims, say, and rape and murder children, are cowards. And once confronted with overwhelming state power, will become perfectly well-behaved and compliant inside. And therefore, the officer's perspective, their mission, guided by their mission statements, will be to make these guys' lives as easy as possible. They will get the privileges, and they will eventually get transferred. So that we've severed it. The mission statement that I propose for departments of corrections would reintroduce the word punishment. For the worst of the worst of their worst, their lives should be as unpleasant as the Constitution permits. They should not be playing, and they shouldn't be having good food. They should be eating Nutriloaf, which is a tasteless but nutritionally complete patty that will not foreshorten their lives but will not give them pleasure. But do be aware, Doug, there's another side to this retributive perspective, which is that we're also imprisoning for life without parole right now in excess of 3,000 people, apparently, who have committed nonviolent crimes. We retributivists are just as much against overpunishing as we are against underpunishing. We as a society should be just as committed to rehabilitating criminals whom we're going to release and not punishing them with grotesquely long and indiscriminate punishments that resemble the same punishment we're giving the worst of the worst of the worst. It's about being more discriminating. And so the second part of your question, in terms of what would a revised statute look like, a revised death penalty statute and a revised statute that specified life without parole, which should be reserved for many fewer people than it's presently reserved for. It's indiscriminately given in many cases where it's not deserved. It would eliminate the felony murder aggravator. More people are on death row right now for robbery murders than any other single aggravator. And because a person kills in the course of and in furtherance of robbery does not mean he killed from a pecuniary motive. And it does not mean that the person sitting in the getaway car shares that same responsibility. It would be a statute that required a higher and different burden of persuasion in the penalty phase where the jury decides life or death. In the guilt phase, the appropriate question is, did he do it? And there, rationality strictly should come into play. The jury should be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt the facts that qualify him to be convicted as a first-degree murder. But in the penalty phase, where the question is life or death, there should be a different and a higher burden of persuasion. First of all, the jury not only should have no reasonable doubts about his guilt, they should have no real doubts. They should have no residual doubts. Now, the United States Supreme Court has held that the Constitution doesn't guarantee that instruction about residual doubt, and I think they're wrong in that. So the jury should have to be convinced not only beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it, they should have to be convinced with no residual doubt that he did it, and furthermore, that's not enough. They should have to be convinced to a moral certainty that he deserves it. And as Adam Smith brilliantly pointed out in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, for which he was more famous in his lifetime than Wealth of Nations, at base, every moral question is an emotional question. And so we're back to that theme where Emotion should be rightfully part of the jury's decision to execute or to spare at a burden of persuasion that's higher.
Robert Blecker, law professor at the New York School of Law. His book is called The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Joined us from a studio at Carnegie Hall in New York City. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about some of the philosophical questions at the heart of capital punishment. There are a number of recent events that got us thinking about all of this. A botched execution in Oklahoma, a call by a Utah lawmaker to return to the firing squad, talking about some of the moral, ethical questions involved when the state decides to impose the ultimate punishment. Heard from Robert Blecker earlier in the program. Joining us now is Austin Sarrett, who is a professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. His new book is called Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions and America's Death Penalty. He's joining us today from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. And Professor Sarrett, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You write, the focus of your book, of course, are these botched executions. And you write that botched executions have been and remain, in fact, an important part of the story of capital punishment in this country. Say something about that. In what way are they critical to this bigger story?
Sure. They're critical to the bigger story of capital punishment in the United States because, after all, at the end of the day, punishment is not an abstraction. Punishment is not a philosophical issue. Punishment is an issue of what it is that the state can legitimately do to those who have violated its laws. And the commitment of the state is to be better than those who are punished. And our capacity to deliver effectively, reliably, and in a humane way, the punishments that we prescribe is really, I think, at the center of our commitments as a political and a constitutional society.
In the book, you point out that from the beginning, really, American execution practices have been designed to differentiate the violence inside of the law from the violence outside of the law, to set it apart from the crimes. And I guess that's what made lethal injection so appealing. You can do this clinically or invisibly, as you put it.
Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, the idea that when we punish, we want to be different and better than those that we punish is as old as the American Republic itself, or at least as old as the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. The prohibition of cruel punishment marks a distinction in the Bill of Rights. So if you look at the protections of the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, the Fifth Amendment's guarantee against compulsory self-incrimination, the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a right to a trial by jury, those are all protections for people who are legally innocent. And then there is, sitting in the Bill of Rights, the Eighth Amendment. And the Eighth Amendment is a protection for those who are legally guilty. So one might ask, why is it that we would afford this protection to those who are legally guilty? We afford this protection to those who are legally guilty because, and even Justice Scalia himself has recognized this, we want to be able to say that at the end of the day, we are better than they are. We are better morally, we are better legally, and we are better politically. And the movement in the technologies of execution has been an effort to find a way of carrying out the punishment of death that most clearly marks the distinction between those who commit crimes and those who punish. And let me say, I think anger is justifiable, no doubt about it. The question is what we do with that anger and whether or not we allow that anger to drive the ways in which we respond to crime. The test of a humane society, the test of a decent society, is its capacity to exercise restraint in the exercise of power. That, after all, is the central commitment of the entire Constitution of the United States, and I think most clearly expressed in the Eighth Amendment.
You say capital punishment never simply means just death. Instead, you say it's tied to the instruments used to carry it out. Explain that, if you would, because I guess what you're saying is that our sense of whether it's okay to execute someone depends on whether we trust the technology to do it?
Much of the conversation about capital punishment in the United States is carried out at a very abstract, philosophical, and moral level. And words like deservedness are used, what people deserve. My own view is that punishment is informed by moral considerations, but at the end of the day, punishment is not an abstraction.
Yeah.
How we punish, what the instrumentalities are, their effectiveness, their reliability, their humanities, has to be at the center of a conversation about punishment writ large. And if we cannot deliver a form of punishment which seems to us to be deserved, if we can't deliver it in a way that doesn't damage our own values, then perhaps we need to rethink that form of punishment. After all, when we punish, we say as much about ourselves as those who we are punishing. Mm. We express the kinds of people and values that we hold, the kind of people that we are. And I do think that it's the temptation of a parent in the face of an unruly child. One can give in to the instinctual anger, but when you do that, what do? You model a response that's premised on anger or hatred, and by modeling it, you encourage it in others. The Supreme Court has said, and I think they're right in this, that the government is the primary teacher, and that what the government does sets an example or a model for citizens. And nowhere is that clearer or more true, I think, than in the institutions of punishment.
You write in your book that we've killed people in this country or in the colonies before we were a country in any number of ways. We sawed people in half. We beheaded them. We burned them. We drowned them. We crushed them with rocks. We tied them to anthills. We buried them alive. And it seems like there's this pattern. I mentioned this earlier in the introduction that, as you say, whenever we move to a new form of execution— You say we start talking about the previous methods as archaic or barbaric. I wanted you to say something about that, this idea that we feel like we're evolving.
Sure. If you look in particular at the 20th century in the United States and think about capital punishment, what you've seen is a movement at the beginning of the 20th century, the primary method of execution was hanging.
Yeah.
That was replaced in the early part of the 20th century. The primary method became electrocution. And some states either didn't go to electrocution or went to lethal gas. And then most recently, beginning in the 1980s, the method of choice has been lethal injection. At each of those stages, in each of those periods, really the same claims were made. And the story of capital punishment in the United States is really instructively a story about a kind of romance of the idea of scientific progress, that we could find a technology that would be reliable, safe, and humane. And alas, I think the story of capital punishment that needs to be told is our rather consistent failure and inability to deliver on that promise. But you're right to say that the belief— and the effort is to produce a form of punishment which is compatible with the evolving standards of decency of a humane society.
How common is it for an execution to be botched in this country?
Well, in the book, we studied executions, every execution in the United States from 1890 to 2010. And what we found was if you look at every method— don't differentiate among the methods, that about 3% of executions are botched. And by a botched execution, what the book adopts, what I hope is a rather neutral and fair definition, namely a botched execution is an execution which doesn't follow the explicit protocol or the taken for granted and understood standard operating procedures. That means if you look at hanging at the beginning of the 20th century, the expectation, the belief, and the protocol was that a hanging would kill someone by breaking their neck. Mm-hmm. And thus, if someone strangled, that's a botched execution. Or if someone was beheaded through a botched hanging, that's a botched execution. Similarly, if you look at electrocution, if an inmate catches on fire during the course of an electrocution, that's a botched execution. So I think what we're caught between the desire to produce this reliable, safe, and humane forms of execution and the reality of a rather regular error rate in the practices of capital punishment. And let me say one other thing, and that is that the most unreliable form of execution is, in fact, lethal injection. We found that about 7% of lethal injections have been botched.
In the book, you tell a number of stories, most of them fairly gruesome. One, for example, you begin the book with the last public hanging in Sampson County, North Carolina. This was in 1900. Do you want to say something about that, if you would?
Sure, but before I do, I just want to say this about the book. I think the book tries to tell a gruesome story in what I hope is not a gruesome way.
Right.
What the book does is the book tries to locate every story of a botched execution that we tell in the life of the condemned and also in the details of the crime that they committed. So it's not a book that simply wants to elicit sympathy for those who are condemned. It wants to locate what the state does in the larger story of those people's lives and in the lives of those of their victims. In the Gonzalez case, which we start the book with, the state used a method of execution, hanging, and the technology was to use a stepladder. And to push the condemned off the stepladder. In the case of Consalves, that didn't work, and he had to be boosted up again and put on the stepladder a second time before the execution was successful. Most botched executions, the overwhelming number of botched executions, result in the death of the condemned. They're botched in the way in which the condemned is killed. And after all, the Constitution commits us, if we're going to use capital punishment at all, to kill in a way that is not cruel and to kill in a way that does no more than extinguish life itself.
Where does the story from last month fit in all of this, the incident that Robert Blecker referred to? And I mentioned this is the Oklahoma case where inmate Clayton Lockett's vein apparently collapsed during the execution. It took something like 40, 45 minutes for him to die. Finally ends up dying of a heart attack. Some sense it was a pretty painful death. Where does that story fit in this? I guess this is it a sort of textbook botched execution?
So let me answer that question by locating this problem in Oklahoma in the larger story of where we are in the national debate about capital punishment. I have enormous respect for Robert Blecker. I think there is no more articulate and thoughtful advocate for capital punishment than Professor Blecker. But I do think that there is a difference here. And the difference is whether or not we debate about the death penalty we should have or we examine the death penalty that we actually do have. And historically, botched executions have played very little role in the overall debate about whether or not we should retain capital punishment. They played a substantial role in moving us from one technology to the next. I think in particular in the movement from electrocution to lethal injection, the phenomenon of botched executions was central in convincing many states to move to lethal injection. But to understand the significance of what happened in Oklahoma, you have to understand the broader conversation. I believe we're in a period of national reconsideration of capital punishment. Indeed, I would go further, and I believe that the death penalty is in decline in the United States. And maybe to go a little too far, the death penalty is really in its death throes. And the kind of argument that Professor Blecker makes, I think, is a symptom of this, what I would call death penalty on the defensive. What's happening with the death penalty in the United States? Well, a decade or more ago, About 300 people a year were being sentenced to death across the United States. That number's been cut by two-thirds. A decade or more ago, the number of people being executed, the high point was in 98, 99. That number's been cut more than in half. And I think, in a sense, Americans, to mix a metaphor, are voting with their feet. The best indication about American attitude toward capital punishment is not what people say in response to an abstract survey question or even a hypothetical scenario. It's what they do in the jury rooms when, having heard the case in all of its detail, more and more Americans on juries are refusing to impose capital punishment, choosing for another punishment, typically life imprisonment without parole, instead. In that context, this context of a national reconsideration of capital punishment, growing doubts not about the death penalty that we might want to have, but about the death penalty that we actually do have, I think the execution in Oklahoma, the botched execution, really struck a chord with Americans and adds just another weight on the scale increasingly leaning against capital punishment in the United States.
Can you tell, Professor, if that reconsideration, as you put it, is based on the fact that we just don't trust the technology? Or is it that we have a larger ethical reservation now about the aspect of the death penalty?
I don't think that the issue is primarily ethical or moral.
Yeah.
After all, if you ask Americans, as a moral matter, are you in favor of capital punishment? Americans would say yes, many would. But then if you ask them, are you in favor of running the risk of executing the innocent? Many people will say no. Are you in favor of the death penalty? Yes. Would you be in favor of the death penalty if it were imposed based on the race of the victim or the race of the offender? No. Are you in favor of the death penalty? Yes. Would you be in favor of imposing the death penalty because someone had a poor lawyer? I think the answer to those questions are no. More and more, I think the question of the death penalty in the United States is as much about us and who we are as it is about those that we punish. And more Americans, I think, are worried and concerned that the death penalty is damaging central American legal and political values.
Let's take a call. Aaron has been waiting in Los Angeles. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Doug. Yeah, I'm originally from Salt Lake, and I'm working here in Los Angeles as a journalist, and I listen to your show every day to get information, so thank you so much. My comment has to do with firing squads. Your previous guest mentioned that he thinks that firing squads should be brought back as the normal method used for the death penalty, but that means that more people are brought into that awful fold, and ultimately what becomes, I don't know how else to put it, a cycle of more murder at that point, and it no longer is about ensuring justice for the victim.
Yeah, well, it's something. Let's let Professor Sarah, because this is something, Professor, you've thought about. Surely the effect of this, not just on the condemned, but on those who are supposed to be administering these punishments.
I think that's an important. I think it's an important concern. I'm not sure it's the primary concern, and I think your caller has really raised a very important set of. Set of issues. After all, when we punish, we seek to do justice. And when we punish, we seek to exemplify a set of commitments and a set of values that makes the society in which we live worth living in and worth defending. It may be that we're tempted to use methods of execution either because they bring satisfaction to the victim or because they feel to us in some sense, to use Professor Blecker's words, that they impose an appropriate amount of suffering on the condemned. I think when we punish, what we're trying to do is we're trying to uphold a set of values. And what the caller referred to is the idea that the death penalty might be like murder. And I think in articulating that, what your caller has done is to remind us that when we punish, we don't want to replicate the acts of those that we condemned, no matter how tempting it is to do so.
Professor Austin Serrett, his new book is called Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions, and America's Death Penalty. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Austin Serrett. He's a professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. We're talking today about the philosophical questions at the heart of capital punishment. So I wanted to ask you about this idea. I wonder if you and Robert Blecker are together in this idea of whether you agree in how these mission statements or statutes ought to be changed or refined. I wonder if you do agree with the idea that there ought to be, we ought to take some of these principles and refine these statutes, refine where we're headed, the mission statements of defense departments, corrections departments, those kinds of things.
I don't think the job of prison guards is to punish. Prison is the punishment. I don't think it's the job of those who administer the punishment, those who make sure that it works and that it functions. I don't think it's their job to become the punishers themselves. After all, punishment is about what we in a democratic society, all of us believe to be appropriate. And the truth of the matter is there is no right punishment for any crime. The question of how we punish is a very complex political and legal judgment. The Lord doesn't will a criminal code for us, doesn't tell us that the punishment for residential burglary at night should be time in jail or, if so, how much. Those are judgments that humans make, and they make them in a political process, and they make them in very complicated ways. And I'm really suspicious of any formula, no matter how limited its claims, that would make punishment seem to be a kind of easy and almost mechanical process. And I'm especially leery of an attitude towards punishment that would let loose as punishing agents prison guards or wardens. Their job is not to punish. Their job is to carry out a punishment prescribed through legal processes controlled through constitutional values.
I wanted to ask you, Professor, finally, this, something that you mentioned, the result of or what happens when an execution is botched. There's this break in the ritual, this break in the sense of routine. What happens when something like happened in Oklahoma happens?
Well, as I said, I think that what happens is that, executions are not supposed to make headlines anymore. They seldom do. A botched execution, this kind of rupture, this kind of disruption, is a reminder of the ferocity of what it is that we do when we take someone's life, and it is a reminder of the difficulty of doing that in a way that is safe, reliable, and ultimately humane. There is no easy, and there is no necessarily effective way of doing that job, and a botched execution reminds us of the difficulty of trying to carry out this perhaps justifiable anger and turn it into effective punishment.
That's Austin Serrett. He's a professor of jurisprudence and political science at Amherst College. His new book is called Gruesome Spectacles, Botched Executions and America's Death Penalty. He joined us today from the studios of New England Public Radio. That's there in Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, and thanks for such an intelligent and interesting conversation.
Let's come back to Robert Blecker here, finally, the last few moments here. And I wanted Robert Blecker to get – we don't have a lot of time left. But to this question, I wanted to give you this chance to respond to this question that that Professor Serrett mentioned, and that is that we should be focusing not on debating what we should have but what we do have in the system. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, he's quite right. And what's so frustrating is that when governors appoint so-called study commissions, which are really designed to abolish the death penalty and disguised as study commissions, and you testify before them and you start proposing all sorts of reforms in order to make what we have better, they don't want to hear about it. It's all or nothing. Either stand pat or abolish it entirely. In terms of comparing it to murder, as your caller did, and that we should somehow be better than and different than the people whom we're killing. Well, of course we're better than and we're different than. And the fact that we respond with killing to killing
doesn't make us murderers and doesn't make us hypocritical. After all, we value liberty, and yet how do we respond to kidnappers? We imprison them. We take away their liberty. We value property. How do we respond to thieves? In part, we fine them. So the fact that we kill some killers doesn't make us murderers, doesn't make us hypocritical. It makes us engaged in a like-kind response, and we have a deep intuition about that, giving someone a taste of their own medicine, fighting fire with fire. We have all these metaphors that reflect the deep moral understanding that appropriate punishment starts from a like-kind response. In terms of the allowing the corrections department to administer punishment, they do it now. They have what they call punitive segregation, which is self-consciously punitive, but it's reserved for those who act up once they're inside. The point is that how we punish those who are committing violations inside, sometimes very trivial, like possessing contraband, which can be homemade wine, that's not where the punishment should be primarily. The punishment should be a response to those who committed the crimes. And then finally, in terms of the botched execution and the 3%, do notice that that definition includes appearances that have nothing to do with painful experiences. They include, for example, the execution that I witnessed, where it was difficult to find a backup vein because the condemned was an addict, a drug addict. And so the execution was delayed by 20 minutes past its start time. That constitutes a botched execution, but that's not botched in any meaningful way. The great irony of all of this is that we have an illusion of a pain-free death in most cases, which may not in fact be pain-free, and we have an illusion of a painful life in prison, which in most cases is not painful. What we need to do, in my view, is directly face the deepest question of punishment. What should it be? How should it be administered? And how can it be an appropriate response to the crime, staying connected with the past?
Robert Blecker. This book is called The Death of Punishment, Searching for Justice Among the Worst of the Worst. Joined us from a studio at Carnegie Hall there in New York City. Robert Blecker, thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I should mention that we have a video related to this question of capital punishment on Video West, so check in there, videowest.kuer.org. I'm Doug Fabrizio.